You're listening to Brainwave on Leeds Student Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to Brainwave on Leeds Student Radio. My name's Lissy and I'm joined by Lawrence Thompson. Lawrence, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, Lissy. My name's Lawrence. Like Lissy says, I'm the president of My Matters and the welfare rep for the union.
So for people who don't know what My Matters involves, could you tell us a little bit about the society that you're head of?
So it's a society that's aimed towards improving mental health services and mental well-being on campus. We do that through lots of things. We do an annual conference, we do lots of fundraising events, we do campaigns. So last year we did a campaign that was to do with improving services on campus. It's called the Time to Change Pledge, and the union and the university signed that. And we also offer our own welfare services, where we have a email that anyone can drop in, ask for advice, send off that email over. We have a welfare hour where people can drop in, just have one-to-one discussion about anything that they'd like. And we also have, as of last night, we have two support groups, an eating disorder support group run by Student Minds, and then a mental illness support group run by Rethink. So we're really happy with the progress that we've made over the last year and a half, and what we're trying to do is developing that into something more cohesive.
So Lawrence has told you a little bit about My Matters as a society, and what Brainwave hopes to achieve is that My Matters and everything that you guys do with the society is brought to a wider student population. People often, if they have been struggling with mental health issues, do come to the union and to look for advice. They are often pointed in your direction. But we figured it would be a great thing to bring it to the airwaves and see if we can reach out to even more people who are struggling with mental health problems on campus at the moment. So like Lauren said, lots of different ways to get in touch. And if you would like to speak explicitly to the radio show, we are on Twitter at ThisIsLSR. And also, if you'd like to just sort of let us know what you're thinking, engage with the conversation. But also, if you'd like us to give you any advice, Lawrence and I aren't professionals, but we can definitely point you in the right direction. And also, give you a bit of feedback in terms of what you're looking at, what you're looking to gain from listening to this radio show. So today's topic, as you might know if you listened to last week's Brainwave, we look at a topic each week, and this week's topic is going to be the subject of men and mental health. So what does it mean to be a man and suffer with mental health issues? Now, we've spoken about this quite a lot, haven't we, Lawrence? And it's come to our attention that there's a massive social taboo surrounding men and mental health. Do you want to outline some of the problems that men, particularly those in sort of the 18 to 25 demographic, experience when they're at university and also just in general life when it comes to mental health?
So I think it's really difficult because you don't know where to start with this, because it's such a huge issue and there's no real starting place that gets you on a hook to everything else. I mean, when we talk about what it is to be a man, you know, the experiences of different men will be incredibly different. So, for example, men, sort of mental health issues for international students who are men, there are so many different dimensions to what's going on there that we do need to have a sort of measured conversation. But I think there are certain things that are really important and are really stark that just demonstrate it more than anything else. I mean, we can look at how the majority of suicides continue to occur in adult males, accounting for 3/4 of all suicides.
Wow, that's awful, isn't it?
And I mean, those are official government figures. Mm-hmm, those are, yeah. I mean, 3/4. And we can look at how women are more likely to have been treated for a mental health problem. That's 29% compared to 17. And we can look at how men are more likely than women to have an alcohol or drug problem. And 80% of those dependent on alcohol are male. And so I do think there is a gender dynamic underlying this massively. And I mean, we're going to talk today about the student setting, but you know, when we think of mental health outside of that, we need to look at things like post-traumatic stress disorder and schizophrenia, where we need to dig deeper than treating male problems as something intrinsic to maleness, and instead look at the experiences that these men are facing that perhaps are disproportionate because of who they are. And so what I really want from today's show really is, on the one hand, accepting that there are certain experiences that make people, make men, especially sort of army veterans and things like that, more susceptible to certain mental health problems. But then basically looking at how we raise our sons differently to our daughters. I wonder how much of an impact that genuinely has. Josh Thomas, the comedian, said once that I feel like part of the issue is this idea that men are meant to be resilient. This surprised me, he said, because men commit suicide at a rate of 3-1 to women, which is crazy because it's better to be a dude. You get paid more, you get male privilege, you've got the patriarchy on your side, you don't menstruate. It's good. It's really good. Up until the age of 8 or 9, boys cry the same amount as girls. And then they get taught to stop. They're not allowed anymore. And it's ridiculous. And this fear of looking weak, or looking feminine, or looking gay, is stopping men from talking about their feelings. And then they kill themselves. And that was his quote. And that's... I feel like that's what's going on. I mean, when we talk about resilience, and when we talk about the sort of archetypal ideas of what it is to be a male, you know, what are the male-sanctioned emotions? You know, violence and anger. But we know that they aren't really conducive to any solution and any problem in terms of our emotions. And the fundamental problem that we have is that some male-only spaces, and male-only spaces or male-dominated spaces, the whole idea of vulnerability is just not looked at. And we're going to be listening to a clip real soon, but the point, if there is anything to take from this show, is that we need to look at vulnerability. And we live in a vulnerable world. And the fear of accepting that and living in that vulnerability and accepting that it's okay to be vulnerable sometimes is hard. And speaking as a male, as a man, but not speaking on behalf of all men, it's really hard for me because I've never even had... Before I came to university, I never even encountered thinking about it in terms of vulnerability. It was just, right, let's get this, I don't know whether that's because of who I am, but I know that I'm much more, right, let's find a solution, let's get there. But sometimes there isn't solutions. Sometimes things are just genuinely hard. And I don't know. I don't know whether we've got any good ideas on how to fix that.
Should we listen to this TED Talks clip? Yeah. If you want to introduce it a little bit, we found a clip about gender and shame and basically reiterating what Lawrence was saying in the sense that if you are a man, it's just ignored. It's not a seen solution for men to be able to reach out. And there is a shame in talking about your feelings. So Lawrence, if you'd like to introduce this for me.
So this is Brené Brown, who's a researcher from Texas. So she will have the greatest accent you will ever hear. but she's a shame researcher. So she looks at how the impact of shame and the fear of vulnerability really drives so many of our decisions. And so this is a great clip just for capturing the essence of what it is and the gender dynamics we face.
The other thing you need to know about shame is it's absolutely organized by gender. If shame washes over me and washes over Chris, it's going to feel the same. Everyone sitting in here knows the warm wash of shame. We're pretty sure that the only people who don't experience shame are people who have no capacity for connection or empathy. Which means, yes, I have a little shame. No, I'm a sociopath. So I would opt for, yes, you have a little shame. Shame feels the same for men and women, but it's organized by gender. For women, the best example I can give you is Anjali, the commercial. I can put the wash on the line, pack the lunches, hand out the kisses, and be work at 5 to 9. I can bring home the bacon, fry it up in the pan, and never let you forget you're a man. For women, shame is do it all, do it perfectly, and never let them see you sweat. I don't know how much perfume that commercial sold, but I guarantee you it moved a lot of antidepressants and anti-anxiety meds. Shame for women is this web of unattainable, conflicting, competing expectations about who we're supposed to be. And it's a straitjacket. For men, shame is not a bunch of competing, conflicting expectations. Shame is one. Do not be perceived as what? Weak. I did not interview men for the first 4 years of my study, and it wasn't until a man looked at me one day after a book signing and said, I love what you have to say about shame. I'm curious why you didn't mention men. And I said, I don't study men. And he said, that's convenient. And I said, why? And he said, because You say to reach out, tell our story, be vulnerable. But you see those books you just signed for my wife and my three daughters? I said, yeah. They'd rather me die on top of my white horse than watch me fall down. When we reach out and be vulnerable, we get the shit beat out of us. And don't tell me it's from the guys and the coaches and the dads. Because the women in my life are harder on me than anyone else. So I started interviewing men and asking questions. And what I learned is this. You show me a woman who can actually sit with a man in real vulnerability and fear, I'll show you a woman who's done incredible work. You show me a man who can sit with a woman who's just had it. She can't do it all anymore. And his first response is not, I unloaded the dishwasher. But he really listens, because that's all we need. I'll show you a guy who's done a lot of work. Shame is an epidemic in our culture. And to get out from underneath it, to find our way back to each other, we have to understand how it affects us and how it affects the way we're parenting, the way we're working, the way we're looking at each other. Very quickly, some research by Mihalik at Boston College. He asked, what do women need to do to conform to female norms? The top answers in this country, nice, thin, modest, and use all available resources for appearance. When he asked about men, what do men in this country need to do to conform with male norms? The answers were, always show emotional control, work is first, pursue status, and violence. If we're going to find our way back to each other, we have to understand and know empathy, because empathy is the antidote to shame. If you put shame in a petri dish, it needs three things to grow exponentially: secrecy, silence, and judgment. If you put the same amount of shame in a petri dish and douse it with empathy, it can't survive. The two most powerful words when we're in struggle, me too. And so I'll leave you with this thought. If we're going to find our way back to each other, vulnerability is going to be that path. And I know it's seductive to stand outside the arena, because I think I did it my whole life, and think to myself, I'm going to go in there and kick some ass when I'm bulletproof and when I'm perfect. And that is seductive. But the truth is, that never happens. And even if you got as perfect as you could and as bulletproof as you could possibly muster, when you got in there, that's not what we want to see. We want you to go in. We want to be with you and across from you. And we just want for ourselves and for the people we care about and the people we work with to dare greatly. So thank y'all very much. I really appreciate it.
Brené Brown for TED Talks there. Here on Lead Student Radio, you're back with Brainwave. Lawrence and I are in the studio, and we are joined now by Ben Winton. Ben, welcome to Lead Student Radio.
Thank you. Nice for having me.
So any responses to that clip, first of all? Lawrence, I imagine you have a lot to say about what Brené was talking about, her shame research, and also this idea that women are maybe the ones that perpetuate the shame, because the way that we bring the idea that we can not allow people to speak about their feelings as eloquently.
So I think what Brené touches on, which is, it doesn't sound revolutionary, but it could be. It's this idea that gender roles, gender expectations affect men and women. That actually, even though male privilege is real, and male privilege is a massive problem in lots of different spaces, when we talk about vulnerability and when we talk about having emotions and being able to talk about them, and at the end the quote about the man in the arena, that accepting imperfection is really powerful. And so what I get from the talk and that clip is a sense that it's not that sort of women are doing this to men, it's just that the entire game is rigged against any sort of any sense amongst men that this is okay to talk about, that this is okay to talk about deep, deep vulnerability. I think in fairness, I think that's changing. And I do think that's really something that's more to do with the last generation than ours. But we still see it. We still see that bad behavior. And I mean, you guys will have to answer for you, but I know amongst my friends, there are significant numbers who just cannot deal with emotional conversations. And that's both men and women. But I think it's something I see the behaviors more in men. And I see that especially in amongst the older men, especially in my family. And so when you go home for Christmas and things like that, you do see this sort of blasé attitude to anyone like that.
I think it's very interesting what she was saying about silence and judgment, this idea of a petri dish, and that's where the shame sort of manifests itself. Because like you say, some of these things are eased with speech, with vocabulary, with talking. And if you're not able to talk, then how can this shame ever be eradicated? Ben, thoughts on that clip?
I guess to pick up on what Lawrence was talking about a little bit, which it puts forward the notion that feminism is good for men too, and that in many ways there are a set of ideals projected onto men that are not in their interests either. This has many implications. One quite extreme one is that men have been on death row for hundreds of years, and only the first woman to have ever been put on death row happened about 2 years ago. And so you can talk about criminal responsibility that way, but we're talking more specifically about the general public. And perhaps another latent pressure would be still expectation to be the major breadwinner. It's something that even feminists amongst men will still have implicitly there, maybe one of the last things to ebb out, if you will. And that these have quite serious implications, I think.
I think especially on that point to do with breadwinners. I mean, if we were looking at this from a sense of government policy kind of thing, in the 1980s, the amount of men that were laid off in the mines, if you look at those villages now, the legacy of mental health problems in those areas, whether it's manifested in addiction or whether it's manifested in something else, is huge. And I think the hidden nature of that and the cumulative nature of that needing to be the breadwinner combined with long-term unemployment is just a huge problem that's never talked about in terms of gender dynamics. It's always talked about as an employment crisis, as though that happens in a vacuum. And yeah, I think that bothers me because clearly there's a gender dynamic at play, and clearly we need to deal with it.
And I mean, a lot of the problems of mental health stem from a whole invisible dynamic of what's going on. We're being straitjacketed by a set of implicit expectations that we're beginning to realize, we're having our consciousness raised that we don't actually need to abide by them and that we can restructure our reality. But all of these implicit expectations have in some ways worked in men's favor to the bias towards men and against women, but also has led in the other direction and has meant that there's less openness, and that maybe these expectations, while they work in terms of something like monetary success, in terms of internal success and contentment and self-satisfaction, these are not the sorts of things that men are supposed to be concerned about.
And I think what you're talking about there is in this idea of what success looks like is so harmful when, for example, there was a discussion a while ago about sex education in schools and whether that should be sex and relationship education. And there is a scourge of homophobia underlying a lot of what happens in British schools. There is just, I look back now and what seemed like normal behaviour was just completely inappropriate. And I think everyone that went through that system would be able to recognise that. And that has an impact, and that has an origin. It has an origin in what it means to be a man, and it has an origin in what it means to be a certain type of man, and which is inferior and which is superior. And that manifests itself in terms of people that don't identify within the binary of man and woman. And that has homophobic abuse. Even what it means to be a black man is heavily contested, and we need we need to have these discussions in a gendered way, because that's the root of the experience.
I think we also need to talk about the university environment. I think that should be something that we come up to next in the programme. I'm going to play a little song for you now. And also, if you would like to get your views heard, please tweet us using the hashtag brainwave at ThisIsLSR. We'd love to know what you think on this subject.
Hi, this is Lauren, and you're listening to Brainwave on LSR. I'm here with Ben to chat a little bit about masculinity, which is today's subject. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lauren. Thanks for having me.
So could you tell us a little bit about your involvement in Mind Matters and why you're here on the show today?
I got involved with Mind Matters originally when I took up a project in the summer of 2014, raising money for a charity called Place to Be, which is a children's mental health charity. It's a matter that I'm really passionate about, because when I was at school there was no provision for mental health whatsoever, nor was there any understanding of it. And that brought me to Mind Matters in the first semester of my second year. I really liked what was going on, and I'm getting more and more involved as time goes by.
And could you give us a little bit of a background of the problems that you've experienced yourself?
For me, it's more of I call it an erratic social anxiety, where I want to be everybody, and yet when you do that you dilute who you are. And what I mean is, I look at every single society, and I look at every single sport, for example, and every single hobby, and I want to be at the pinnacle in each of those. And you can't be, nor is there's not the time, and no human has the energy to do that. And I really struggle with choosing what to do. And on a daily basis, I suffer from FOMO, which lots of university students know. And it's an ongoing journey with finding who I am and what it is exactly that I want to be.
And how do you think that your masculinity or being a man has impacted on that? Do you think it's had an impact?
I think it has. As a young man, in the eyes of society, I think you're expected to have conviction and know what it is you want to be, who it is you are, what your values are, and what you're good at, and follow them with a passion. And whereas for me, I'm very, very open-minded, and in that way, people perceive it as not having a backbone or not having strong opinions on anything. But I like to be taught, and I like to know new things and try everything that I can. Some people view it as a lack of commitment. Why have you done all these sports? Why have you done all these different things? And that view of masculinity then makes me doubt what I am doing, whether I should just commit to something I don't enjoy because it is perceived well in the eyes of the other men, and that view of masculinity.
And do you think that some of those issues that you raise, such as worrying about being perceived to not have a backbone, those kind of ideas of masculinity and what it means to be a man, do you think those are the kind of things, those pressures from society, that are leading to men having such high rates, particularly of suicide and mental health problems?
I think it is that, and it's a combination. I'd call it, it's like a social artifact, I think. Society is changing disproportionately to the way we view men in society. For example, men are always perceived as the breadwinner, and now I discuss men in their later years, and that puts men under a lot of pressure to have a career that they may not particularly enjoy, to win, to have that responsibility. And then when they have perhaps unemployment or loss of independence, they tear themselves up and they destroy their own egos and self-worth, because they don't think that they can then provide. But at this young age, I feel like social anxiety and depression can be brought on by the uncertainty of the future and not knowing whether as a man you're going to have a stable job and a hobby and things that are going to get you perceived well in the eyes of society, and how is your CV going to look if you're not completely set now.
I read actually a really interesting report from the Samaritans about why men in particular were ringing them, because something like 70% of their calls are from men, and particularly older men who feel like they can't talk to anyone about the economic downturn, how they feel they've lost their masculinity because they can't provide. And you mentioned about young men as well feeling that pressure. Do you think that if we did more to tackle those kinds of feelings, those pressures in young men and adolescent men, children, boys, do you think that we could try and curb such a huge problem of male suicide?
I'm a strong believer that prevention is better than cure in every single facet of public health. And mental health is one of them where that can be done most strongly. If at a young age, young men and boys are taught that it's not a sign of weakness to pursue health about your mind, to pursue things such as meditation to calm the mind, rather than being taught that you have to live strong and man up when you're feeling these problems, and it's not masculine to feel down or worried. You must always feel set on a path, and you must always feel confident in what you're doing. I feel that these problems could easily be avoided if people were just, young men were reassured that it isn't a sign of weakness to search for help.
Yeah, and it is really shocking that suicide is the biggest killer of men aged 18 to 41, bigger than any disease. And do you think that charities and services are doing enough to take into consideration those kinds of pressures on young men? Do you think they're accessible to men?
I think it's not that the charities aren't accessible to men. It's whether the men are accessible to the charity themselves. And I know personally that I, as of yet, haven't gone to institutional or charitable help for what I suffer from. And I know people who suffer from mental health who have. And it's those that take the plunge and, so to speak, swallow their pride and go for help, that they do actually find that there is a lot of provision and understanding from charities about these issues. And I think on the whole, from what I can judge, charities understand the real acute need to help young men and to lower that shocking statistic that you speak of.
And can you think of, as a final point, any one thing or one policy that charities or services could do to make themselves more accessible to men, to help men reach out?
The one way that charities could really, really reach out to men is in their marketing and in their leaflets, to have specific campaigns aimed at men. And depending on the size of the charity, that could be a television advert, that could be a leaflet. But just points and statistics to reassure other men that men are going to charities and men are going for help. And as soon as, I think, men see other men doing it, and especially influential figures, they'll feel motivated to do the same.
And I think it would be really great to see that on campus as well, particularly with mental health societies such as My Matters being incredibly girl-dominated, when we know that we're not the only ones out there suffering. So hopefully, if you are listening to this and you're a guy, come and get involved. Thank you very much, Ben.
You're welcome. And I'd just like to add to that point, if you are a man and you are suffering, then don't worry about it. Get involved. Come to Mind Matters. They're all really friendly. You can speak about your issues there. There's lots of services on campus, and the feeling will pass if you seek out the help.
You're listening to Brainwave with Lawrence and Lissy. Shout out to Lauren, our normal presenter, who can't be here, unfortunately, today. But we are very much pootling along without her, aren't we, Lawrence?
Yeah.
Now, coming up later in the show, we're going to be listening to your Agony Line questions that you've been sending in during this week that are specifically related to men and mental health. So if you have a question that you want to be answered, then please send it in. If you send it to info@lsrfm.com, or alternatively use our Twitter handle @thisislsr, and we can answer your question in our next week's show. But for now, why don't we start off by talking about that clip we heard earlier. That was Ben, who is a member of Mind Matters Society, and he was talking about his personal experiences struggling with mental health and being a man, and also at university, what do men struggle with? Lawrence, do you want to kick off the conversation? What do you think that it is that that men struggle with most in terms of mental health?
I think in terms of my personal experience, it wasn't at university, it was more when I was at the tail end of sixth form. So I was in a situation where someone in my life who was really important was going through a severe mental health problem. And what I found really sort of exceptionally difficult was to try and find any help in terms of the information, because this person didn't want to receive any treatment. And now, as someone who's been involved as much as I have, I know that that was a warning sign that I should have not took on the responsibility for fixing a person, because you can't do that. But it was more that I think what I found difficult was that when I tried to approach, because I went to an all-boys school, so it wasn't as if So like the whole male environment thing to me is just so, was very extremely shown in that environment. But I found it really hard because my friends would ask me about it, but ask me about it in a way that meant they were ticking off a box, because they found it really hard. They didn't have any solutions. And sometimes I think one of the things that I've learned is that sometimes these things are just hard. And it's just to be in that moment and to know that it's hard is really challenging. And it's adaptive, like, but it's challenging. And I mean, I probably wouldn't have, I still would never really identify with the idea of depression or anything like that, but it really did affect me. And it really created an anxiety in future relationships and things like that, because in the end, how far can you push your own emotions in that scenario? And it's difficult because it ended not on the best terms. So that meant that there was a legacy that just was never sort of healed. And I've been exceptionally lucky at university. I mean, when I was at school, all of my friends were male, like all of them. And I had a few friends that were really like at the girls' school who were really like really good friends, but never in the same, you never put them in the same category. Whereas since I've got to university, I mean, I live in a house of seven, and there's five girls and there's two guys. So I do have a different experience there. But I guess what's different is that when something's wrong, people ask. And that was never something that was true at school. And I don't know whether that was school, but I do think that it's an inquiry that people, if I was going to generalize it, if I was going to make it as general as what men do, which, you know, to an extent, you know, it's a kind of ridiculous thing. But this is something that affects most male-dominated spaces. I mean, imagine if I was going through depression and I was in the rugby team or the cricket team or the football team. Well, what's going on there? So, perfect example, Freddie Flintoff. How many people know that he struggles with bulimia? Very few. Because even him as a male role model for someone like me, you know, you see him on a league of their own, absolute boy. And it's hard to reconcile the two pictures. And the reason there's two pictures is because you have to put on two pictures. Like, there's the private person, which is, you know, inside your own headspace. And then there's the public persona, which we all put on a public persona when we meet people who are new, we feel uncomfortable or anything like that. The problem is that sometimes you take that persona too far and it masks things that are quite unpleasant. So what I've always thought is that, so perhaps over the last year, more than any other time, I've actually done the headspace and really invested in working out what went on, like what went on there, and actually being able to separate myself from how I felt. And for so long, I couldn't sort of remember it without reliving it. And that was incredibly hard, because then I just shut down the memory. And if you shut down the memory, you never deal with it. And it's because I've been quite lucky that I've got such like really great people around me. But that hasn't, you know, that's not true for everybody. Not everyone has that. And so when I first got involved in Mind Matters, one of the things that we were talking about was something called Time to Talk. And it's basically, you know, you have conversations and you talk about it. And I, as the sort of brash new person thinking, right, I'm going to solve the world because I couldn't solve the other situation, went, why do we talk about it? We just need better services. Just improve this. Right, so let's lobby some MPs. Let's do this. Let's do that. And then I had my political hat on for far too long and realized actually the conversations do matter, that actually the personal connection is what's real. And in the end, that's what saves it. And you can talk about services and you can talk about things like that, which are essential. But I do think the conversations have to come first.
Ben, do you think there are places that are particularly in the university environment that lend themselves to these conversations? Do you think there are places we can go, or even people that we can talk to? Not necessarily, like Lawrence says, not necessarily the services that we have at our disposal, but certain places, certain people that are easier to start these conversations up with.
It's a hard question to answer because there's so much variation, and first of all, there were so many people on campus. There were 32,000 people, and that they kind of switch every couple of years. So I have some ideas in mind of when there have been spaces that have been very good, but then within a year they turn completely the other way. So I have in mind that I'm Jewish and a member of the Jewish society, and I think like other religious societies which have a cultural element, the doctrine's not why people get involved at all, and it's very much a social space where people understand where each other come from, and that there are chaplains who are there, and sometimes these chaplains are brilliant and sometimes they're the opposite of brilliant, and you are putting too much faith in somebody who does not have the training to really deal with it. So I'm skeptical to just automatically encourage those places and those societies. But that's most certainly one that I know people use. And in a good way, not kind of you're weak and therefore you go to hear some sort of divine message to save yourself. No, it's about a support system that's there for good, rational people. But it's not reliable enough, and it most certainly isn't a replacement for something more formal. I never got it at sports societies. I think the opposite is true at sports societies. So no, I'm really struggling to answer on that one. Obviously, I found Mind Matters much later in my final year, but nothing particularly comes up. I mean, in fact, the opposite. I had a personal experience of dealing with mental health, and the amount of time it took to actually find the people who could help me was absurdly long, and that included, along the way, counselling services, also the lead student medical practice, and apparently it's reported that student medical practices under-prescribe antidepressants on the basis that they expect students to just be homesick. Mm-hmm. And that...
And self-diagnose as well, I imagine.
Yes, and that means that when... I sympathise with needing to find the balance, but it means that when you have people who really do need the help and that they get ignored, once there's a psychological issue, it's a very difficult, expensive and long-term solution that comes in. And so the amount of trust that you have to put into an individual initially, and only then 8 or 9 hours along the line can be able to ascertain whether they're helping you, whether this drug is helping you, whether this therapist is helping you, that crucial time if it's going in a downwards direction. And I think that most certainly this is a criticism that can be met, and that we can at least create those spaces, even if it's just the medical practice.
Yeah. No, you make a very good point there. Now, I've got a question that has come through to the LSR email account. It says, "Dear Lawrence and Lissy, I've struggled with depression for a few years now. Nothing seems to be getting any better. Although I've had 2 bouts of counselling, I really struggle to talk to people about it. Could you give me any advice?" Now, as this is Men and Mental Health, I do know that this has come from a gentleman who listened in to last week's radio show. Now, what do you think would be the first piece of advice, Ben, that we can give this young man?
I think that it starts with taking... You kind of have to take a leap of faith that when you're not in the moment of intensity... For my understanding, depression comes and goes in waves or episodes, and that a real issue is that people deflate what's happening to them, that when they're kind of in more lucid states, they say, oh, that was in the past and that's okay.
It doesn't matter, perhaps.
Correct. Mm. And that you're kind of past it, and that it takes a long time to admit that there's a more serious trend happening and to decide in your lucid state to do something about your more intense episodes. So I think that to recognize that trend and say this is something that long-term needs a solution gives the good disposition, and then to take that slightly more seriously, I'd say particularly like if you feel at risk, take it slightly more seriously. You're not being melodramatic. Take it higher up than you otherwise would. Don't go for the minimal qualification. There are so many people who say they're qualified to deal with mental health out there who have just had a counselling. They have a counselling certificate after doing a course for 1 year and they're literally talking at you. And then there are ones who have been training for 9 years in complex cognitive behavioural therapy established by Albert Ellis. And I think these are the people who can really help you. So being assertive, or at least hopefully you have a support system in place around you to for somebody to be assertive on your behalf to get you to some of these people. You want to spend as little time as possible kind of doing the searching to find somebody who takes you seriously enough. So I would go straight to being referred to a psychiatrist and start there. And if they say you're not serious enough, then they'll give you the person who they believe is personally a good person for the job.
Now, you said that if you have a person that can speak for you. Now, this person expressly says that I really struggle to talk to people about that. Do you think that it's an issue if you're struggling to talk to people about it that you don't have anybody speaking on your behalf? Where would you advise this person to go if they don't know how to make that first point of communication?
At the end of the day, it's always going to be the case, and so it is truthfully with lots of skills, and it's just unfortunate that in this particular example there's a greater imperative on making the jump. You're going to have to open your mouth. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult unless you have an extremely emotionally sensitive family or friend who will be able to read it and then put you in the incredibly uncomfortable position of forcing an ultimatum out of you, of forcing you to say what you have to say. But you don't want to wait for that to happen. In many ways, that's not good either. So there is no, Haile Selassie says, there's no shortcuts. And it's really unfortunate in this area that from not speaking to speaking, there's no shortcut. You have to just open up to somebody who you trust, who you feel has emotional sensitivity. That doesn't have to be somebody within your life. In fact, very often it's not. You can even practice using Salvation Army. They're not just there for times of extreme despair and attempted suicide. They're there for things like this. And that it's almost like rehearsing in the way in which actors rehearse their lines who are just starting off in a new one. Start that way and then move to somebody either slightly closer or somebody in a position to be able to refer you to the help that you actually need.
Now, Lawrence, they've said in this question, I've had two bouts of counselling, and you were just saying during that last song that there are very different types of counselling and also lengths of counselling. What would you say is the best thing for somebody to ask for when they're worried or when they're struggling with depression? What do you want to get from your GP or whoever is going to advise you?
So I think the really hard thing is so many different things work for different people. So I'd be really hesitant to assert any particular one type.
Give generalised advice, yeah. Yeah, I understand.
So I think the first point, though, has to be, for what I get from this scenario, is why the struggle to talk to people about it, and I know because I've been there, is this idea that we apply a value sort of approach to mental health that we don't apply to any other form of illness, any form of difficulty. And what I would like to see is to just accept that you're worthy of this conversation. You're worthy of people caring about this, you know, about you. So what I think is if you work on accepting that you're worthy of that treatment, that you're worthy of having conversations about this, that you're worthy of being better, like as in, you know, working through this problem, then that's the starting point. So if you can work with your GP to get there, and it really is a partnership with whoever you're working with on this, don't accept any sort of hierarchical, I'm in charge, this is what you do. You know, really work through it together.
Thank you very much for that, Lawrence. Now, I'm afraid we've come to the end of Brainwave, so thanks for tuning in if you have been doing so for the entire hour. Next week, we're going to be looking more into this issue, this relationship with your GP. So actually, that was a really nice point to end on. We're going to be talking to you about really the first steps you can take if you're struggling at university, the questions you should be asking with your GP, and also what you should be pushing for as a student and as a member of society. So Lauren will be back next week, and she'll be helping us talk through that discussion. If If you have an Agony Aunt question that you would like us to answer, then please send those through to info@lsrfm.com. Or if you're feeling slightly more brave about it, tweet us @thisislsr with the hashtag brainwave.